Right, the House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome to the House Education Committee. If you have a cell phone with you, if you please take it out of your purse or your pocket or your backpack and turn it all the way to off, not just to vibrate, but all the way to off, so that there's people listening on the internet and the transmission signals mess up the recording, which is really unfortunate. Plus, your testimony is going to be so interesting that you aren't going to care what's happening outside of this room. I'm confident that that's true. I just wanted to extend our apologies on behalf of the committee for being late. I know all of you made great efforts to be here today. There were a couple of caucus meetings that ran over, and we do have some members that are testifying on bills in other committees. So you'll see people coming in and out of the committee room. That's just a symptom of this part of the session, and it has nothing to do with what you've just said. So if you say something really important to you and somebody walks out, please don't think you've offended them. They just have a bill they need to go and testify to. So with that, I would like to open an informational meeting on autism. And we have a set of folks who have come for invited testimony, and then we will open it up for public testimony. So Nancy Latini, Emily Sampson, Florian Gerlou, Annette Scowan-Gooch, and is Representative Edwards in the room?
Yeah.
He'll be here soon. And if I've called your name, go ahead and come on up with Nancy Latini. And our custom here is when you begin your testimony, if you will start by stating your name for the record, that helps us historically document the occasion. Thanks. Please,
Representative. Thank you. Representative Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. I'm going to briefly overview the autism services in Oregon for children with autism ages birth to 21. I'm going to provide you with some information about a common framework that the department expects as far as services are concerned. You'll know that each geographic area, you might come from an area and say, well, gee, it really doesn't look this way in my area. A lot of that is going to depend on the types of children that are there, the parents' requests, and the skills that the teachers have at this time. I'm also going to tell you who these kids are, how many there are, and what we're doing to ensure services for these children and their families, and then to identify some of the missing pieces that I think we still need to have in order to scale up the services for our children. Background, you all know about the growth of autism in Oregon. It's been tremendous. The information as well, the new information is plentiful that comes out. On the second page of your handout, you have a chart that shows over time, actually it's the back of the first page, a chart over time of the growth of autism birth to 21 in Oregon, so you can see what we're working from. Also in your packet, you have a sheet right after the testimony that's called Quick Facts on Autism Spectrum Disorder, and it contains some interesting information. When autism first became an identified disability under the federal special education law, there was widespread disagreement on what the causes were and what the treatment should be. Well, those struggles still continue, but we've had far more research since then, and it does give us some way to formulate what we should be doing for services. The range and intensity of autism is wide and varied, and hence the term spectrum is attached to this disability. What we do know, however, is that we do know from research and from our own practical experiences that early intervention begins giving us a better chance at mitigating some of the problems that we might have in schooling. And so we certainly know that the earlier we catch these kids, the better. As information on autism grows, also the more important thing for us to do is to continue our communication with all the other agencies. These families usually have lots of different agencies working with them, and these families deserve a common message of some sort that we should all be working toward the same goals for these children. As far as early childhood special education programs, early intervention, early childhood, there are a lot of federal mandates that guide the services for these children, and we expect our 9 ESD contractors to comply with these. I'm going to name just a few to show you what the intent of the law is. One of them is to accept referrals from a variety of sources, looking for agencies that might have referrals, looking in the medical field, wherever it is that we need to have look for these children who may need our services. And this is also called Child Find, and in the law, the continual Child Find effort so that we don't leave kids that need our services unattended. Also, there are specific timelines for determining if a child is eligible and when the services begin, and these all have to be at no cost to the parents. And the service delivery systems vary. We could go in their homes, which is something that, again, research shows some very positive outcomes from, do training, do direct services. We can have special toddler groups or baby groups with parents involved with class training. We can also just support the actual preschool program that the child might be in. We also expect continual progress monitoring on whatever those goals are that the program and the parent have decided on. And most important to me is that transition plan from preschool to school age. Change is a really critical time for young children, and most often adjusting to change is a critical issue for children with autism. So we really watch carefully how we make those plans and do them in a timely manner. It is in the law, and we expect it to be followed, but it's also a spirit of really doing it in a planful way. For school-age programs, with the exception of in-home services, there are a variety of options for our children, again, based on what their needs are. Many of our students with autism are full-time in a general education classroom. Some of them are in a general education classroom and part-time in a special education resource classroom. Some of them are in full-time special classes, and then some of them have individual support or any combination of these. Whatever works for the child is what the team should be creative enough to support. The school districts are charged with the primary responsibility to assure that these services are provided. Resources are needed to go to train staff, general ed and special education people, to make sure that they know what the latest information is and that they can apply it. They also need time to plan together. It's also critical that our regional programs are available with their expertise to support these districts and to support the students so that they are successful. The department then is charged with seeing that the programs are carried out in the districts and that those programs are aligned to federal and state law. We use a formal process to look at the compliance and the outcomes, but we go further than that because we know there are more important things than just the compliance when we're working with children. The Oregon Parent Training and Information Center conducts workshops throughout the state and throughout the year on topics regarding autism. Portland State University, since 2003, has worked on a development in a statewide effort to develop model training sites and provide support services to students, but also to provide professional development to teachers, administrators, and parents, pre-K through 12, high school, I should say. The very last page of your handout shows a map of where those sites are at this time. Eventually, we see this as a statewide network that would allow families to access services and information no matter where they choose to live in Oregon. Parent training sessions are available, as our staff regional workshops are available to them, on-site hands-on training in the classroom, the model sites, and also training specialists to help to consult with classroom teachers.
I think this is good.
We also, the department has some guidances enhancing these programs and what we expect. I can tell you we're not there on all of these expectations at this time, but we really hope that programs reflect a comprehensive integrated service delivery system, meaning all the agencies working with that child know what's going on in that plan. We need to make sure that parents understand the roles of all these agencies and that we're all headed in the same direction for their child. We expect these children to be able to participate in the statewide assessments and the appropriate statewide assessments that are aligned to what their education plan says, and also the capacity building and expertise at the districts, which we prove is evidence when they start developing or wanting to develop these model classroom sites that I talked about. We've been involved with Portland State University on an outcome study that they started in 1998 with 122 students. They are now doing a follow-up with these same students, and we're anxious to see what the outcomes are. The department participated in the Health Resource Committee, and we're very active in the Autism Spectrum Disorder Work Group that was chaired by Representative Chris Edwards. Many of the recommendations that came out of there are directly or indirectly related to education. There's also a small community work group that is working on improving communication in different areas at the local level, and they maintain contact with us, and so we know what they're doing. So the needs of autism in Oregon leave a lot of work for us to do. We do need to have a system that looks at a standardized way of training, of service delivery, and of standards and expectations. We need an adequate supply of teachers, trained staff that we don't have. We need the service of intensity and frequency that the students deserve in early childhood through the transition plan to adulthood. This can be accomplished by looking at across agency, I believe, state agencies working together. I'm very excited about the commission that's formed. We are so excited about it. We're going to fund half of the position of the executive director so that we can get moving on this. Also, ways to accomplish all of these goals. One of the things that we're doing right now is with our stimulus, federal IDEA stimulus funds, we sent out a list of things that districts could use those monies on, and one of them is starting to be creative in planning for students with autism. We should start acting on some of the recommendations from the Autism Spectrum Disorder Work Group. We also need to address the needs of those districts who choose not to be in the regional programs for whatever reason. Their children and their teachers still need the training. And we also need to assure that whatever we're planning to do, that we include the parents and families. That concludes my comments. You have a lot of people here. I'm going to stay, and so if you have questions now or later, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Nancy. And I think we'll hear from the panel and then come back to questions after that. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the group. My name is Emily Sampson, and I'm the parent of a 3.5-year-old boy, Parker, with autism, and I think that my testimony is going to begin with a short video. Do we have to do it
there? Mm-hmm. Thank you. I didn't realize that. Sorry, that's why you said that.
Okay.
sail the ocean. He had captured my emotions, wrapped them up just like a gift at Christmas time. I thank the Lord above that he was mine. I pray to God that everything was fine. And after months we saw him changing. Nathaniel's speech was rearranging, so we took him back to see what they could find. And after ironing out the creases, they came up with missing pieces, and they told us that autism's on the rise. I looked into my little baby's eyes. Promised him to find the reasons why. Now I lay him down to sleep. I pray the Lord my son could speak and make him strong where he is weak. This I ask of you. Just like him, there's many more that need our help to win this war. And who knows what might lay in store to help them make it through. Doctor says there's so much more to do. Put the pieces back together, but it's up to me and you. So now we lay them down to sleep. We pray the Lord they all are weak. This we ask of you. 'Cause now we know there's so many more that need our help to win this war. Who knows what might lay in store to help you make it through. Yes, who knows what might lay in store. Missing piece is me and you.
Mm-hmm. 18 months ago, when Parker first was in the early intervention system, he was a little boy who sat in the corner. He didn't notice if I walked in the room or if I left. He didn't know that I was his mommy, and he really didn't seem to care. When I initially sat down for his IFSP meeting, I went in knowing that these children optimally need over 25 hours a week of intensive service if they're diagnosed young to make the strides that will enable them to be hopefully a part of our society as they become adults. When I went to that meeting, I fought long and hard for the 5 hours that I got, 5 hours a week. My husband and I both work for a nonprofit, and financially we were not able to just go and pay for 20 more hours a week of service for Parker. So I did the best with what I had, and as the therapist came into my home and worked with Parker for an hour a day, I was like their little stalker. I sat in the corner, and everything they did, I did. I took notes. They brought reinforcers. I made my own reinforcers. They made picture schedules. I made picture schedules. My husband and I spent every night researching and reading books and doing everything in our power to save our little boy. Parker was that little child in the corner, and 18 months now, because of services provided by early intervention, he is a little boy who asks questions. When he gets in the car, he says, "Where to going, Mama?" I mean, I would not recognize this child that I have now, and I know that so much of that is due in part to early intervention. And so I'm just here, I'm just a mom, but I'm a mom that firmly, firmly believes that early intervention is huge to these children. It's huge, and it's important, and as we're looking at funding for the following years and budget cuts, which I realize have to happen, that there isn't always equal, and that programs like early intervention saved my son, and I know they will continue to save other children. Thank you.
You and I appreciate everything you said about early intervention, but I hope you also know Parker's excelling because he has a mom and a dad that are so focused and sitting in the corners and sitting up late at night and finding all the information, and he can't excel without you, and it sounds like you've done a remarkable job for him as an advocate and as a teacher, so thanks for doing that and sharing so much of your story with us today.
That is hard to follow. I think she sums it up really well about her experience for herself and Parker and her family. So I'm Florine Derlew. I work for EC Cares in Eugene, Oregon, and I am an autism specialist. I focus on children newborn to age 5 or up through kindergarten, if you will. And with that in mind, I also supervise classrooms that are part of the Portland State Model Classrooms. I've been involved with the Portland State Studies since 1998 myself, and so have some of my students. Involved in those classrooms, we do a lot of training on evidence-based and research-based teaching strategies, and that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. And so given that, I think the really good news is, and I think Parker's a great example, is we know that there are research-based strategies that work for young children, and they're so strongly needed in terms of how they can impact children and their families in terms of quality of life, you know, for the rest of their lives. And so it's so very, very important. What I have attached, I don't want to be redundant, so attachment A by the National Professional Development Center on Autism Specialists. spectrum disorders does outline some of the recent research studies. There's four that you can look into further if you want noted that are recommended practices for children and young people with autism spectrum disorder. Some of these are teaching strategies, and some of these are more like tools, like visual schedules, supports, social stories, that type of thing. But the ones like discrete trial, picture exchange, peer-mediated instruction, pivotal response training, those type of things are specific teaching strategies that we use that are ABA-based. So given that, the research does suggest that early intervention programs that are indeed beneficial for children with ASD and often improve developmental functioning, such as we saw with Parker, and decrease maladaptive type behaviors and symptom severity. It is not a cure, but it is a hope for families, and there is progress for children. The strategies that are noted really exemplify what's considered good teaching in, as it relates to ABA-type programmings. And as you go through them, you will see in the research that these ABA strategies teach very complex skills and very systematic sequences, from very easy to very difficult. They provide very unambiguous directions for children, so it's clear. There's assistance and prompting and reinforcement as needed for children. There's response criteria, so you kind of know what to push forward, when to back up, what you need to change, that type of thing. And there is a whole series of task analysis, time delay, all kinds of behavioral, what we call behavioral teaching strategies used. All of that takes trained staff. And so one of the things that is real important, at least from my perspective, is that these best practice supports need to be individualized. So you can't just use the same method, if you will, or the same targets for each child. A teacher needs to be able to use what's best for that child. They have to know how to assess the child, see what is needed, determine what method will be used to teach the child, and then implement those strategies. Also, some environments need to be considered. Some children need real quiet environments that are fairly distraction-free. Others are in busier environments. So there's many, many factors that go into implementing these types of programs. Given all of that, some of the issues that we have related to implementing these teaching strategies is staffing really needs to be adequate in order to do these instructional programs. Most of the children, when they're Parker's age, and even like up through kindergarten, really require one-on-one or two-on-one instruction. These are not kids who know how to learn in groups. If they knew how to learn in groups or in typical preschools, they wouldn't be with us. They wouldn't be coming to us for help. They would be progressing on their own. So staff support in intensity is real important. Another factor is staff training. You kind of mentioned that when you spoke, but it's not a one-time shot. Teachers need to be trained in a variety of methodologies to meet the range of children and be able to get support on an ongoing basis so that as their children grow and expand, that they can know how to move kids on or back up and how to modify and that kind of thing. So it's not a quick and easy fix for teachers. And so training needs to have a component that is ongoing. Children need programs that have teachers that are skilled in these methods. They need to have teachers who understand and can plan for generalization. So if you're teaching in a very structured setting, that these skills that you teach are generalized into the home, into the community, into their lives. Because otherwise, don't get me wrong, but why bother teach them? So you need to have that plan for generalization. Also, there needs to be consistency in attendance in terms of the number of days. You know, when I hear 5 hours, I kind of cringe because that's not much. We like to recommend 4 or 5 days a week. That would be preferred so that there's some consistency for the children. Also, to be considered are what's nationally recommended in terms of the amount of time. 25 hours per week is what's recommended nationally for these kids using research-based instruction. That's a lot of time. It's not 5 hours. That's why she was referring to the extra 20, I assume. Also, families need support in education. The families have these children 24/7, and so there needs to be some component in the program that has that family focus. There need to be mainstream opportunities for children as they are ready to handle that, so they have peer models. And We need to look at comparable services across the state. We're a large state, and there need to be some, you know, comparable offerings so that the big metro areas don't have a lot and the smaller rural areas don't have much at all. So anyway, that's what I wanted to share today. I really appreciate the opportunity to share, you know, my opinions on what's needed education-wise and for teacher training. And if you have any questions later on, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Two questions. First is an explanation of low incidence versus high incidence disabilities, and where does autism fall in it? And
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, I'll take that question. Low incidence is a term that's used for those students with a disability that is probably pretty significant disability or unique, but yet there's not very many of them. And we would look at those are the programs that are students that are served through the regional programs, deaf and hard of hearing, blind, visually impaired, orthopedically handicapped, traumatic brain injury. Autism is in that group. Autism is growing so quickly that some people say it probably doesn't need to be low incidence anymore. But when you look at the 13 categories of disabilities, it's still pretty low on the scale. And quite frankly, to just say they're not in regional programs at this point, but just leave it up to the districts would be pretty scary. And so at this stage of the game, to make sure we have that structure, they still are nationwide considered low incidence. High incidence would be those that we have a lot of and still a wide range and not all that easy to teach either. Learning disabilities, speech and language, mental retardation, emotional disturbance, those are higher numbers, and yet many of those kids have far less needs as far as intensity of services.
Representative Parker, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair, but we can sprinkle this out, because I have one more question.
Why don't you go ahead and ask your question? Representative Parker looks like a patient man.
Okay. Follow-up to that, and that is, follow-up, is there a reason, is there a difference in funding between high and low incidence?
Representative Gelser, Chair Gelser, I should say, Representative Maurer, there really isn't a difference in funding from the federal government. What we do is concentrate some of our state funding to the regional programs so that they can hire the expertise. An example I usually use is if you have a student at John Day that needs a mobility teacher because of a visually impaired child and needs that person maybe a couple hours a week or so, it's hard for them to find that person, whereas in the regional program, they could hire a full-time quality person and share the caseload across a couple of school districts. And so we concentrate some of our state funding to regional for those reasons.
Right. Now my next question. It has been suggested to me that we currently deal with clinical diagnosis for ASD, and that we actually need to be looking at a functional diagnosis.
And clinical meaning medical?
Yeah.
Do I want to try that? I don't know. I'm not probably the best person to answer that, but my understanding is medical is very different from educational. And so a medical diagnosis or a clinical diagnosis of autism does not equal educational services. There are separate diagnoses.
The point is that we should be dealing with, we shouldn't always be relying on a nebulous, in this case, it is hard to pinpoint a clinical diagnosis. Or a differential diagnosis, but functional diagnosis can be measured.
That the functional in terms of how their educational needs, how they educationally portray themselves and perform, and then what their needs are. When they do an ASD eligibility educationally, you're looking at kind of how their style of learning is and how to best teach them. So that is much more functional, in my opinion, in many ways. Some children do benefit from a medical diagnosis if they have coexisting diagnoses, which a number of our kids do.
The funding follows a medical diagnosis?
And funding follows educational. It does not follow medical. They're separate diagnoses.
Do you want me to add to that?
Yeah, please add to that.
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, as far as the federal law is concerned, the child has to have the disability disability and have an impact that needs special education services. So, for example, I'll take it away from autism for a minute. A child may be physically impaired and in a wheelchair. That's a disabled person. But he may be just fine in all of his classes and doesn't need any help in special education. So we wouldn't put him on an individual education plan or call him disabled. Child with autism, I don't want to lose sight of, it's very important to know about those medical, that medical information. That's the issue around the cross agencies, learning to talk to each other and look at the entire child. But nonetheless, for educational purposes, we have to have that impact on that learning style or whatever the learning is. And that it sometimes is far more difficult when you look at the very young children, younger than three, and sometimes that medical diagnosis is going to help us to drive to that.
And one of the pieces with the medical, if I could add to that, if you don't mind, Chairperson, is, you know, for example, I have many kids on my caseload with feeding issues who don't sleep at night. I'd say 95% of my kids have severe sleep disorders. I have some that sleep 2 or 3 hours a night. I have some children that eat 4 to 6 foods total, you know, like that's their diet. Of course, that's going to affect their education. So we have to collaborate with those medical people. We want to collaborate so that we can help their physical state be ready for learning, if you will. They work together.
Representative Parker, did you have a question?
I did. I still do. Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to the three of you and everyone else for what you do here and outside of here on behalf of all these kids. Because, like a few of us on this committee, I'm on the health care committee as well. I wind up in conversations about this not infrequently. And one thing that I hear periodically addresses or is related to the table that you have, the rapid increase in the number of people in birth to 21 that are identified as being part of the spectrum. And I would love to have an answer to this question, and maybe people in this room can help me with it, okay? The question, the rise is remarkable. There's also, I believe, an expansion over time of recognized spectrum. How much does the expansion of spectrum account for out of the rise? And out of the expansion of the spectrum, is the rise in the more severely autistic spread evenly across them or in the other regions of the spectrum?
Representative Gelser, Chair Gelser, why am I saying that? Representative Parker, I don't think I can quantify your answer here without going back to look at all of our data, but I can say that we are getting better at diagnosing children and knowing what they are, and the spectrum is a part of that. I understand that. We also, I'm very aware of students who would still be on special ed child count, but maybe not under this identification. In the past, we've called many of our students with autism mentally retarded, emotionally disturbed, all sorts of, because we didn't know and we didn't have the diagnosis. But as far as your percentage and where they fit over time, I would have to go back and look at our data first, and I would be glad to do that or have my staff do that. Get back to
okay,
you.
Okay, great.
Okay, we'll see what we can pull off.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Maybe this gentleman to my right knows the answer. He wants to tell me something.
No. I asked the same question, except you expanded it by saying, you know, where in the spectrum is the increase occurring. And if you're looking for a problem, sometimes you can find it. And so I think it's from a standpoint of how big is the problem. Is Oregon just better at finding the problem? Yeah. The answer I got was no, that there's a national standard and that generally the states are, you know, we're comparing apples to apples. Because I think that is a legitimate question to be asked.
I agree, and I think I might have asked that as I started to watch the growth as a special ed director in my earlier time. I can't say that in my experiences in the school district as well as at the state level, people very carefully look at identification. I would say that that they agonize over it sometimes because they also know that a whole set of other rules come with this as far as assuring accountability and assuring outcomes for kids. They want to make sure that they're putting their energies and their funding to the right students. But I will go back and see what I can find as far as the best way I can find out what the spectrum where they fall.
Great. I'd appreciate that. Thanks. It doesn't say anything. The answer that I'm looking for doesn't say anything about, for instance, Parker. right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not questioning any of that.
Yeah,
I'm looking for a more thorough understanding and the ability to answer these constituents who come to me repeatedly with this and related questions. So
we'll
thanks.
Do our best. If I may add to that,
yes.
Chairperson. I attend national conferences on autism, and what I have been hearing is that there are many factors that are looking at the increase of autism across our nation and throughout the world. Some of the biggest research is going into genetics, and some of it is going into environmental toxins. That's the big one these days, is that there's more and more environmental toxins being introduced, and the children I serve and the children people are having with autism are not able to process the toxins as well as my understanding, that their body absorbs them easier, but they don't excrete them. And so there's a lot of research going out into looking at environmental toxins, genetics, that type of thing. But that's a big key one. The past, I'd say, 3 or 4 years is looking at environmental toxins. It's not the answer, but it's a big piece that they are looking at in terms of the increase worldwide. In Lane County, the biggest number that we see when we look at level of functioning and ability of children is we are seeing more complex children with autism, with or without mental retardation, but with more severe behavior issues and their neurological systems being more disruptive. And so we are seeing more challenging children who seem to have some other things going on physically. They still qualify for autism. They meet all the criteria. But we have every year more and more children with challenging behaviors, and that kind of look like there's just something else going on physically with it. So that's what we see down in Lane County.
Representative Dimbro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to the developmental educational side of things. And all three of you seem in agreement that the best strategy is early intervention and intense intervention, and by early meaning at the preschool level.
Early meaning as soon as they can be identified. We have some children 11 months, 13 months, so older infant, toddler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Nancy, you suggested, I think, that this... that there is a public responsibility, you know, to do this education. Federal mandates, state authorized, delivered through the regional ESDs, right? And you had mentioned 5 hours a week in some context. And then, Florian, you mentioned the
25.
The ABA, yeah, the 25. And so how does this get worked out in practice? I mean, ideally, Florian, you said it's a one-on-one or two-on-one kind of intensity is what's most effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so how exactly do we make this, can we make this work?
Can we talk about that?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I can tell you how we work it out in Lane County. So first of all, as children progress and they're able to learn how to learn and they can go into, if you will, doubles, being taught in like a group of two, then we can go on to groups of three or four, and then we start mainstreaming out. So we kind of have a system. It's very systematic. It's well thought out. It's discussed with parents. We look at where they're going, because where they're going plays a big impact. So how do we do the 25 hours in Lane County? They vary. The average, we have children going at preschool, say 3 to 5. We have some children getting 8 or 9 hours a week. Some get 15. And when I say an ABA program, I just want to be clear that it's not just like discrete trials. So this is a program that has an umbrella of good behavioral, you know, applied behavioral analysis as a principle of teaching. So it would include a variety of teaching strategies that I outlined. So it's not just one strategy. And what we try to do is incorporate parents into the instruction, similar to what, you know, you mentioned. Sometimes it's home visits. We do parent coaching, which, again, came through Portland State, where parents come in and are coached on how to socially engage and get communication with their children. Parents love that. They take it home. We do support groups regarding grief and loss issues. We do behavior management groups that parents can attend, and we do what we call autism topic, their parent education group. groups. So we may teach PECs, so their child's learning picture exchange at school, and now they carry it home. It may be how to we just did one on feeding issues. So feeding issues at school, this is how we're addressing it. How can you address it at home? So we're trying to get those extra, if you will, 12, 10 hours more via the family and having them incorporate it into their routines at home as functionally as they can, so the child's able to, again, participate in the home life and in the community, in having the teachers be the guide for that or a specialist. Sometimes it's an OT or speech therapist, whoever it may be. Mm-hmm. So this afternoon, we have Dr. Randy Feltz from CDRC's talking about to the parents about medical issues related to autism. So each week it's a different topic, and then we generalize at home.
Mm-hmm. And follow up. And who coordinates that, Florian?
Team,
as it were.
The autism team. We have an autism team, and we work as a team to coordinate all those services.
For each individual child.
For each individual child. So, for instance, I supervise 36 children's program, so I'm responsible for those 36. But when I offer those parent education series or the coaching for the communication and social engagement, they're open to anyone in our system who has a child with autism. So we just, I may be running the group, but other people can come.
Can I speak to that as well? Just as from a parent's point of view, they really just enabled me to figure out ways in my everyday life to work with Parker, whether that's ways of engaging him while we're in the grocery store, or I was telling a story about when he was little and some of the best therapy he ever had was in the shower, because you could take something, he really wanted that cup of water filled, mm-hmm. and he still does. So it's started out with just good looking and giving him the water, to having him sign, water, there you, good job, to now, I want water, please, Mama, and giving him the water. And just finding ways that, there you go, you can spend an hour in the grocery store working with your child. You can engage them at the park. So just finding ways in your everyday life. And that's what really these groups and these parent trainings have just enabled parents like me to do.
And I'm trying not to ask this question, but I can't help myself. Grief and loss.
Uh-huh.
Do you balance that with something more positive in relationship to who these? I tend to think of grief and loss as death, and generally, when I know someone that has a child, whether they have Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or a typical, mm-hmm. I say congratulations, you have mm-hmm. a beautiful new child,
mm-hmm.
and.
So I'm not a parent of a child with a disability, and perhaps, she could address that yourself, Emily. But we offer grief and loss groups that are open to all the EC Care families, and hands down, 10 out of 12 of them are parents of children with autism. And I think part of it is that they don't have the same kind of social opportunities. They can't take their kid to the park because their kid's going to melt down or run away. And they can't pick them up anymore because they're too big to haul them out screaming. And so these, I think they find this as a place that they can go. It is a loss. It's a loss of the dream that they had, if you will, when their child was born, and they're having to reshape their dream. There's a poem about a trip to Holland, and they thought they were going to Italy. And Holland's still beautiful, but it's not Italy. And that's kind of what the group is about. It's about finding hope and finding the good things, even though the child's not what you thought you were going to get. And we have varied from someone like myself facilitating those groups to mental health therapists, and now they're being laid off, and now we're going back to doing it ourselves. It's varied depending on funding on who supports those groups. But the bulk, but hands down, and same with the behavior management groups that we run. At least half, they're offered to the whole system, 1,000 families, and half always are kids with autism.
And if I can just add to that, I think that, at least with Parker, I did have huge feelings of grief and loss, and it was only for a while, and it was something that, like I said in my video, Parker was typically developing up to a certain point. He would laugh and play peekaboo, and you'd say, Parker, how big is Parker? And he'd do the whole, so big, and then he was gone, and there was this little screaming child on my floor, and I didn't know who he was, and he didn't know who I was, and it was like my little baby had died. this little child that I had wasn't there anymore, and I didn't know if I would ever get him back. I had visions of him being an adult screaming on my floor and me honestly feeling like, I don't know what to do with this child. So for me, it was profoundly, it was grief and loss in the most purest sense of the word. But through that, like I said in my video, there was hope. And so it was this feeling that, you know, he may not be the child that when he was born, I had visions of. But he has taught myself and my husband and my sons things I never thought were possible. He's used every day to make us better people. And I think that teaching parents that and showing parents that, yeah, it might not be what you initially envisioned, and it's okay to feel grief and loss for this child that you had pictured, but in that there is hope.
Thank you all very much.
Madam Chair,
yes, Representative Maurer.
I apologize, but I found something that I had a document that kind of, I need to get back to this issue of functional diagnosis. How do you folks, how does the education community interact with the mental health community?
Mental health.
Because that's, I mean, I know there's House Bill 3000, and it's Ms. Gelman's committee. But how does this, because there's a play between the education community and mental health, and I know education, it's expensive. And it takes money away from other things, mm-hmm. and you know the pie is only so big mm-hmm. in the world. And
so perhaps there would be a better person to address the like school age and adult rather than myself, because I can just address what I know from a young child's perspective and their family. It is a difficult link in the sense that we're always working on it, but. I'm going to be really blunt. A lot of the traditional mental health people that we have through our county mental health services or private psychiatrists and stuff really don't have an expertise in autism. They don't get that learning style and functioning. So they can treat maybe with medication and doing some processing and all that type of thing. But we are finding that a number of them are not really educated, if you will, in autism. And so we are finding more and more individual practices open up that are private, that are people specializing, if you will, in working with people with autism and their families in terms of meeting their mental health needs. But it's been a challenging link, and it's also challenging in terms of separating some of these diagnoses. As I mentioned, we're seeing more people with challenging behaviors, and to discern whether it's a mental health issue versus an autism issue, and to diagnose mental health, if you will, DSM-4 mental health criteria. I mean, for little 3-4-year-olds, I mean, you don't want to diagnose them with, you know, schizophrenia and depression, and I mean, like, I don't even know that they can. So it's kind of complicated.
And that's the problem. The problem, and
it's a
we
problem.
Need to move on. I apologize.
Yeah, it's a problem.
But that's the problem. And rather than waiting for a medical diagnosis to intervene so they can get on Medicaid, mm-hmm. or Medicaid services, you need to look at where their development is, and mm-hmm. and not label them, because you give them a DSM-4 diagnosis, and I'm sorry, but they're...
Yeah, it can be a mistake. Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
Okay.
Functional diagnosis.
Briefly, just as a time check for everyone, we have 5 more panels.
Oh. So I apologize, ma'am.
Representative Gelser, I'd like to close this with, I think that is the hope of what this Autism Commission is going to do and help us with. The work group was very instrumental, and it was the first time for me that I felt comfortable that we all, agencies, could talk to each other about what we all needed to do and that what we could do, and for us to be pulled together. I think I have hope in that commission, and I'm sure somebody else will talk about that.
Thank you all very much, and thank you for bringing the video, Parker.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Representative Edwards and Annette Scowan-Gooch, please. And in whichever order you choose.
Go ahead.
Okay. Representative Gelser and House Committee on Education, thank you very much. I'm Annette Skarin-Gooch, and I'm a coordinator of regional programs here at Willamette ESD. We serve a three-county area that's around Salem. I began working with Autism Services and in regional programs with their inception, and I was part of a group of three that worked through our Oregon Department of Education to develop regional programs for our state. And the tremendous amount that we have learned over that time is astounding over the last 25 years. I just want to summarize, because I know that you are on a time crunch, I just want to add to some of the testimony that you heard earlier and summarize the complexity of autism spectrum disorder, but also the complexity of teacher training and professional development when it comes to supporting our students. When I'm out in schools and working with families, when I'm working with teachers, I use the term choreographed instruction, because that does give a picture of the detail that we need to pay attention to when we're working with our children. We have many successful programs out there. Some of them you heard about a little bit earlier. There was reference to parent coaching series. We just finished the parent coaching series last week, and the series is five instructional classes along with an individual parent-child coaching session so that they can apply what they learned. And just last week, we had a father of a preschooler walk in to the group session, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "I had a breakthrough." He was so excited because he connected with his child, and the difference that makes. Part of that difference was because the coaching went along with the instruction. In another area, you heard about the intensive classrooms. Florine teaches in an intensive classroom, and the focus of those classrooms really having a milieu of instruction for autism. But we also have a range of supports through our other grade levels. For example, with higher functioning students that are primarily in mainstream general ed classrooms, we have a group of regional autism specialists that developed a curriculum adjusting the image that has been accepted for publication. And through that direct work, our autism specialists direct work with students, they've been able to really teach to relationships underlying not just how to say hi, not just isolated skills, but the underlying concepts about what it means to have a relationship, friendship, self-determination, and other critical social information. In your handout on the last page, I attached some real work from one of our autism specialists, and this came from one of our schools with one of the co-authors to the curriculum, actually, and she arrived at the school with a student that had been, frankly, blowing out of music, and he was hurting other students in music. The team didn't really know what to do. Traditional behavioral strategies weren't working. And through this series, these are all posters-sized papers that they were working on. You can see the student started out very confused, and you can see he was having a hard time. He was mad, and bam, he hurt somebody. Looks like he had detention. I see choir and detention on there. Through questioning, the next one, she tried to help him to focus on a sequence and what really happened. And through a couple of sessions, if you look down at the middle row, it took her dividing up that piece of paper into segments, and then the student, on his own, this is his drawing, this is his sequence, he was able to tell her what really happened. The bottom line, it was music. There's one particular note that's very painful. And every time he heard that note, that thermometer went up until kabam, he hurt somebody. That was how they figured it out, and it was really through thinking about the complexity of autism and how that's different from how our own children or our other children in the class may act. So that's an example of some of the direct work our specialists do with students. In the area of teacher training, one thing that we do know, and it's research, is that in-service alone does not work. It does not translate into classroom practices. It's coaching, and it's the addition of the coaching that can bring use of strategies into the classroom from 5% to 95%. So we really focus on our training really being that whole continuum of supports to teachers. ASD is a very young field, and it changes very quickly. And one of our challenges is maintaining and staying abreast with the research, staying abreast with information. It's formidable to try to track information, determine what's relevant, get it out to the classrooms and the teams. And the state has several supports that they've developed that are very positive. Statewide Consultative and Resource Services provides new specialist training. They have an active, very active lending library that families and teachers can check out things, try them before they invest in them. We have an instructional assistant training series that includes coaching in classrooms to work directly with the paraprofessionals that usually are spending the most of the time with our students during the school day. We have regional program, we have competencies for our regional autism specialists, and regional programs in higher education have collaborated with those competencies. Now we have a unified set that we use. Western and PSU both have autism classes and address the competencies. And now when I'm hiring, I have more and more applicants that have a more solid background in autism. And when I look at what the competencies are, we're speaking the same language. That makes a difference. The field is very complex, and we can further develop what we're doing. As just to give you one example, I mentioned many training activities that we're doing. The instructional assistant training series that we do for paraprofessionals, we could take that, we could adapt it, and perhaps use it, use that same training and support folks in other agencies, for example, support people that work in group homes. Very parallel kinds of things that we could do that would not be very hard and be very cost effective. Finally, ASD is a national issue, and knowing that we need to work towards consistency of services across the state, we've looked at other models in an effort to develop improved and enhanced regional as well as district services. I and some others are on state teams, communities of practice, and other forums that allow us much more efficient communications nationally, so that we are trying to move as quickly and efficiently along with others. That concludes my information. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Edwards, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm state representative in House District 14, which is West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Albador. In the interest of time, I'm going to cut out some of my remarks, and because, frankly, they've been said, and I can't say anything better than the professionals sitting behind me, and from a lot of the professionals, I think, that you've probably received emails from. And in fact, I'm not an expert, as I've said over and over, in the field of autism, but I've become pretty darn good at being Simon's dad. And my son Simon is one of those thousands of Oregon kids that has autism. And we could have watched this wonderful slideshow about Parker and just substituted the words Parker for Simon, and it's the same story, almost the same story. You could have taken all those blocks that were all lined up in a row in that picture and substituted food cans. And that's, you know, we have pictures in our scrapbooks at home of that. As you know, I was the chair of an interim work group, the Oregon Autism Project, to really take a holistic look and report back to the legislature about the state of autism services here in Oregon, and to make a series of recommendations for this legislature to act upon. The budget situation has not treated us kindly. However, we have been successful in getting, via executive order, the creation of the Oregon Commission on Autism. And that commission is charged to provide leadership and help establish priorities, facilitate interagency collaboration, implement goals, monitor outcomes, engage the stakeholders, and create a 10-year action plan, and develop necessary legislative concepts. I know a lot of folks, especially that don't particularly, and I hear from parents all the time, who, like myself, believe that time is of the essence and may not have a whole lot of patience with either the legislative process or the bureaucratic process to running a state, would like to see action, concrete action taken quicker. and results in the field more quickly. But I would submit to you that this commission is going to be the facilitator that's going to be necessary to turn. It's like turning an aircraft carrier. I mean, you can't do it on a dime. And we're talking about infrastructure and programs and processes that need to be put in place. Within the first 3 months, the commission will create subcommittees to address autism diagnosis and assessment, which we've touched on earlier, educational endorsement and competency-based assessment for certification of educational autism specialists, reorganization of autism spectrum disorder educational services, and interagency transition services, which hasn't been touched on very much here, but it's not just about early intervention, although I am a very, very strong advocate of doing more early intervention, but it is also about transition from the educational system to the human service system, particularly around transitioning out of high school around that age. I would also like you folks to know that, some folks do know very, very much that we're also working on issues with regard to insurance and human services as well, but this is the Education Committee, so our remarks are confined mostly to that. And I'm very thankful for Co-Chair Buckley and his efforts to make changes to the early intervention, early childhood special education funding formula that is absolutely critical. I personally don't believe, as a child of a first grader with autism, that it can be overemphasized enough how much this is really, we need to be taking an integrated approach. It is not just about the classroom teacher, although it certainly is very much about the classroom teacher. It is also about all the folks around that classroom teacher. It is about a school bus driver that picks up my son every morning, and frankly, if she doesn't do it right, can really alter his mood for quite a while. And he takes that with him into the classroom. It is about the food service worker that knows how to accommodate his particular idiosyncrasies with regard to his diet and what is on the eat list and what is on the will not eat list. So it's about the coordination of all of that in a school environment, in a school structure that is really conducive to that. All of that takes money. And we all understand that as legislators charged with establishing and balancing a state budget. And we're always looking for creative ways to do things with less money. But I would be remiss if I were to lead anybody to believe that we can simply do it without really putting the money to these programs. And this is where I make my staff nervous, because I go off script and say something that could be somewhat provocative, and every time I say it, somebody after the meeting comes up to me and says, well, we don't actually have proof of that, but as a parent and legislator, I'm going to say what I have to say anyway, and that is that we don't know why the rates are higher. We don't know how much of it is better diagnosis, how much of these kids were always there, but we just know that they're there and we can put a label to them now, or how much the actual incidence is higher. But what I would say is that while we don't know that, we also do not know how many of our adolescents and young adults and older adults in the public safety system, in our prison system, are there that are on the spectrum somewhere. And this is completely speculative, but but it's something that I don't hesitate to say anyway, because I know in working proactively with my son, and in working in using behavioral based strategies to address issues from the get go when issues crop up with his behavior. And we're in the middle of one right now. He's pushed a kid at school 2 days in a row. We had a big parent-teacher meeting about it yesterday, and we're working through strategies, and things are seem to be looking pretty good. But we're in a school environment that's very accommodating to him, and the administrators get it, and the teachers get it, and the autism specialists are working with, and there's an autism specialist in the school that helps the rest of the staff get it. And so we are not trying to force a square peg through a round hole. But I submit to you that with these kids, and perhaps with all kids in our educational system, to the extent that we try to force and shove square pegs through round holes, there's going to be collateral damage. And I think some of that damage comes from the kids, to the kids, and inhibits or changes how they function with the rest of society. And I don't know what type of behavior that leads to in adolescence, early adulthood. My own theories about it are purely speculative. I haven't read any evidence to support any of my ideas about this. But as a parent that sees how negative the reaction is when you try to, again, force a square peg through the round hole, and also understands how easily my son can be accommodated if we have strategies and we know how to do that. I have to bring that up because, again, it's not just about the policies that we pass and the strategies that we pass that specifically deal with autism. It is about a much bigger infrastructure and system, and I would hope that we are considering the effects on kids with autism and developmental disabilities as a whole when we're looking at all those budgets and bills that don't even come before the Education or the Healthcare Committee, but may come before the Business and Labor Committee or other such committees. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we have, moving to our public testimony portion, we have 8 parents who have signed up to speak, and I wanted to thank Chuck Bennett of COSA, who has agreed to let them go first. And I also wanted to recognize and thank COSA and OSBA and the Department of Education and the Oregon School Employees Association and the American Federation of Teachers and OEA, if I didn't say that yet, for being in the room for this discussion. We appreciate that very much. So I would call Joe Taylor, Merle Morrigan, and Dora Raymaker, please.
Didn't say
and the Department of Ed. Okay. And yes, committee, thank you for coming. We appreciate having you too. And Kevin, our committee administrator, thank you for coming. I've learned my lesson. I won't do that again. Thank you, Debbie. Welcome. And if you would please start by stating your name for the record, that would be very helpful, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. I'm Joe Taylor. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Autism Foundation. I live in Gresham. I'll try to be very brief today with everything that's going on. But I wanted to make the committee aware of and invite you to the conference that we're participating in called Educating Children with Autism that will be held on May 16th at the Memorial Coliseum in Portland. You've got a lot of materials in Nancy's packet, and others have mentioned Dr. Joel Eric's program at Portland State that has been training teachers and training other district personnel for the last 5 or 6 years and doing a very successful job of it. And we're feeling at this point that the time is there that there's about 40 schools in the state that are doing this, and there's an awful lot of schools left in the state that, as Chris just said, the principal and teachers at his school get it. Well, there's a lot of them that don't get it and haven't even heard of it. And so we're trying with this conference to get the word out to as many school personnel as possible of the effective ways of teaching children with autism in the schools that are working in this state. And I think it's noteworthy also that if you look at the sponsors on this, we're going as much as we can to develop a public-private partnership to come up with funds of organizations that are cooperating with funds and services to make this work. Portland State obviously is heading it up with their team that has been doing this, with the Oregon Department of Education, the Northwest Autism Foundation, and we were lucky enough to bring the Portland Trailblazers in with us on it, who are a very good resource, let me tell you, and very cooperative. So just take this back to your hometowns, share it with your constituents that are teachers, parents, anyone that would really be enabled by attending a meeting of this type, and if there's any questions about it, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the council. My name is Merle Morrigan, and I am an Asperger's autistic. I am one of the, it was quite a challenge to sit through listening to how people react to us when you are one. And I was undiagnosed until my 50s because they didn't know about Asperger's autism, and they only knew about the Kanner's presentation. But I have come to understand my unique life in the light of that diagnosis, and answer a lot of questions about how I perceive the world and how the world perceived me. But I feel that the adult autists of today can help in what the children on the spectrum will need tomorrow. I became involved with a website that's a worldwide site forum for autistic peoples called www.wrongplanet.net. I've given you all of the websites that I'm going to refer to here. After years of volunteer service as a moderator, my dedication to the site was rewarded with more volunteer work as the administrator of the forum. And through that site, I have met hundreds of neurodiverse folks of all ages. Through them, I've realized the opportunities open to the autistic by utilizing primary and secondary online schooling as enhancement for homeschooling and online universities and colleges for autistic adults. I know that the tuition savings alone are worth budgeting for, and e-learning in the educational curricula. E-learning is quality education made affordable. The fact that instructors of the highest caliber can share their knowledge allows students to attend courses from across physical, psychological, and economic boundaries at minimum cost. This can drastically reduce the expenditure of higher education, making it more affordable and accessible to the autistic, who is not constrained to be in the same location as the instructor or the other students. Environmental irritants, allergic reactions, light and sound sensitivities are all solved at the flick of the computer on switch. E-learning reduces the environmental impact. E-learning allows people to avoid travel, thus reducing overall carbon output, reducing dependencies on parents or hiring facilitators to get them to and from physical classrooms, and maximizes class attendance. Taking classes in a virtual environment also allows for the student comfort in familiar surroundings, with little need for either the student or the learning facility to have to adapt existing physical accommodations. E-learning is convenient and flexible. It is self-paced, and the learning sessions are available 24/7. Learners are not bound to any specific daytime to physically access classes. They can also pause and review learning sessions at their convenience and sharing the information with others. I know that the Oregon Connection Academy, or ORCA, is perfect for children on the autistic spectrum, and I encourage you to continue to support, fund, and expand that program. For post-secondary education, the Oregon University System, which is my alma mater in Ashland, Southern Oregon State, has the Oregon Network for Education, has audio, video, and computer technologies for statewide education access. I would like to help bring our beloved Oregon into the new millennium by speaking to and for those who may not be able to speak or express what they need to those around us. We who are in the daily struggle to fit in, to measure up, and to be counted need this reasonable accommodation to be productive citizens of Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
My name is Donna Raymaker. I am on the board of directors of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network and a member of Self-Advocates as Leaders. I am an autistic self-advocate, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself and the self-advocacy community in Portland. It is critical to involve autistic people in decisions that affect autistic people. This includes involving us in autism-related educational policy. I applaud you for having already taken the important step of including self-advocates in the New Oregon Commission on ASD. I hope this is the start of a strong commitment of true inclusion with the primary stakeholders. As the motto of the disability rights movement states, nothing about us without us. In these challenging economic times, this is the second testimony I've prepared in as many weeks. The first was for the Ways and Means meetings, where severe cuts to services to people with developmental disabilities, especially adults and including programs I use, were discussed. While the focus of autism is typically on children, never forget that autistic adults exist, and we make use of the educational system too. Further, as autism is lifelong, today's autistic children will, as I did, grow into autistic adults, and we are adults for a lot more years than we are children. Therefore, I encourage you to fully support disability services in the state and university systems which give autistic adults equal access to higher education. Also, as prerequisite to education, continue to support Oregon's developmental disabilities programs, particularly the non-crisis programs such as the brokerages, housing, transportation, self-advocacy, and employment support, which are the lifeline for many autistic adults. As crisis programs are exponentially more expensive, focus should be put on keeping us out of crisis. Non-crisis programs also employ the many Oregonians who support us. In Multnomah County alone, non-crisis services provide $68 million per year to the local economy through jobs, wages, and the purchase of services and supplies. Developmental disabilities programs must not be cut. They must be strengthened, and the professionals involved in them must be better educated about autism in adults. Finally, it is important that the state of Oregon consult with the cross-disability community regarding media, policy language, and promotional materials related to autism and other developmental disabilities. Like any minority, we need to have input into how we are being represented in order to combat stigma. Please include us in decisions about us. Please consider us as human beings with needs and strengths that carry over an entire lifespan, and who can attend college, contribute to the economy, and have a high quality of life with the right support. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Aaron, I have one. How big is your device? It looks not heavy. The communication device.
It's an iPhone.
That is amazing. Thank you all very much. Our next panel is... Now, I know you, but I can't say the last name that I don't know. So it's Kathy. I'll let you say your last name. Oh, Kate. Kate, and then Kate Turner and Dave Adams. Yes. Welcome, and Kate, you can start.
I'm sorry I don't have something for you to look at. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Katalin Pustavari. I go by Kathy. I am a parent of a child with autism. He's 13. I'm also president of a nonprofit in Oregon called Parents of Autistic Children of Oregon, POAC of Oregon. I am a certified behavior analyst, an associate behavior analyst. It's a BCABA. I'm also pending teacher licensure as an elementary school teacher. I'm here to just give like 3 points. First one is for ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. There's a portion of that called verbal behavior. It's really old, but essentially the gist is this. We teach really young kids that communication pays. So by essentially saying or teaching the child to request things that they find out, wow, I request, I get. And that's something that I would like the education community to really take a look at, because there's a lot of research behind that. And that's pretty much what POAC of Oregon is trying to do, is to bring in the training, generally from the East Coast, to train teachers and parents in this methodology, which is really part of ABA. I'm also a programmer, so I'd like to put out there that with a pending budget cuts, there's such things called open source programming. I used to not like that. Now I do. It's where people all over the world can essentially program things. It could be someone from Nepal, it could be someone from the East Coast, Canada, wherever, and essentially program educational materials that are put out into the public that can be used for free, and they're slow in coming because generally it's volunteers that make it, but people can build upon that. And so with autism, here's the tie-in. Sorry to be long-winded, but essentially children with autism are all different, but with programs, what you can do is you can create these computer programs that allow for differentiated instruction. What that means is that if you have a third grader that's operating at first grade level, that the program can automatically notch down to that first grade level, and the child can then proceed at their level, at their speed. And in addition, a talented and gifted child might be able to start at a much higher level. Doesn't replace teachers, just something to throw out there. I also am involved in the one laptop per child thing, essentially. That is the hardware part of it, but really I'm interested in the platform that is on it that can now run on a Macintosh, on an XP machine, and on any other Linux device. So essentially open software and open educational materials, it may take longer to develop them because generally the public doesn't really put a lot of money in it, and I'm not asking for money, but I'm just saying look out for it. You hear about open educational resources, you hear about open software, you'll know that this might be something that might actually disrupt our educational system in a good way. And then finally, my third point is our state standards really need to be looked at. It's, as a teacher, I look at them, and If I ask another teacher, what does this mean? We probably are not going to agree. And there are other states like Massachusetts that have state standards. Remember, you have to write your curriculum against your state standard. That if we can't agree between teachers what this means, then it's going to be really hard to develop that state's, that software or the curriculum or whatever we're developing. I thank you for the opportunity to speak. Thanks.
Thank you. Hello, welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Adams. I'm the father of a child with autism. Actually, I have two special needs child. My daughter scored 920 on her SATs in the fifth grade. So we've got both ends. I also am a school teacher in the Medford School District and the founder of REACT, a Research and Education for Autistic Children's Treatment. It's a nonprofit school that we started for applied behavior analysis. And my story was, you watched it with... if that would be Lucas in there, almost exactly, other than he would be laying on the floor rolling trains back and forth, but same kind of self-stimulatory behavior. I actually started REACT, and to tell you the truth, when we first started ABA, we didn't know. It was before computers, and we were doing it all by reading books and phone calls. And I didn't know how well it would work. A good friend of mine that we started this with, that's how we became friends. We had children with autism. His son was incredibly self-injurious. I don't know whether you... Have you ever... seen a typical... typical-looking child. It would be different if they kind of look strange, but a typical-looking child. Beat himself until he was bloody. And tear his skin until he tore his skin and would break mirrors with his head. They had to put a curtain over the slider so he wouldn't break the slider with his head, and he never slept. And he was 8 years old and never been potty trained. He never slept through the night. Somebody was talking about that, and screamed incessantly the whole time he was awake. And their parents didn't want to use drugs, so they were about ready to. And when we started REACT, our consultant came in and. The school district in early intervention had worked with him for 4 to 6 years, and it just got progressively worse. In 6 weeks, in an ABA program, he was less than one. He had over 200 self-injurious behaviors a week. A day. He went to less than one a week, was potty trained, and slept through the night in 6 weeks. That's the difference. So. You know, one of the questions you ask is, you know, the grieving thing. My son was real aggressive as well, and I want to make it easier for the people behind me. And one of the things my wife and I did was we went crazy looking for stuff to do for our son, and the only thing that made sense was applied behavior analysis. And they wanted to give us 5 hours a week. And the actual research shows, by the way, that anybody related with research, applied behavior analysis has been peer-reviewed and been replicated at least 2 times already. And it's the only treatment recognized by the Surgeon General of the United States and the National Institute for Mental Health. That's the only one. And when you start talking about how effective it is, one of the standards that I understand that they're trying to use is do a double-blind study is the only way you can make it perfect. Well, that's not going to happen with a behavioral program. In front of you, so what I wanted to do, and I actually almost had this going, believe it or not, what's in front of you is a proposal that would solve almost all the problems that we have in the state. In Lane County, I can't believe they said a minimum of 25 hours. Holy smoke, that's the standard for treatment.
in Oregon. Now, I had no idea. So what that leaves is other schools, unless you want to talk, one of the problems that's been having is that the Oregon Department of Education, if they go, gosh, we need to do this, that they don't have the staff, they don't have the training, they don't have the personnel, and they don't have the money, not in that order. And that's a minimum 25 hours. Actually, the study shows 40 hours a week of intensive in services. So what are we to do? You know, so like in our school district, they hire a parent that's not qualified, that doesn't have a degree to be the behavioral specialist. She can't even sign the IEPs. So they hire her for a lower thing, and so in consequence, there was a little boy that got pretty quiet, wandered away from classroom. A child with autism. They had no idea where he was they didn't even look for him for over half an hour, and they found him drowned in a ditch, and he happened to live. And I've personally seen some incredible things done by teachers to children with autism. In fact, I've gotten in trouble a couple times by pointing out their mistakes. One of the problems with having this in a college setting is to do a training program in a college setting. It's actually a psych degree, but it's a special ed degree. That's what we're looking for. People looking. So the psych department, the ed department, kind of have to get together, or the special ed department. And I actually had it done at Southern Oregon, and then one of the department heads retired. So I got that one on board, and the psych department retired. It was like crazy trying to get people together, and then the next person in didn't want to do it. So here's why you if you turn to page 3 on this, it's kind of the last pie chart. This is the comparison. This is by the way, in the National Institute for Mental Health, the minimum recommended hours are 40 hours a week, especially for intervention, and those are intensive hours. If you look at the bottom one, the one on the left, this has been going on for 30 years, is the average gain of 20 IQ points for every kid in the autism program. One of the things they haven't seen, and you might not with a 25-hour week program, is a child that actually recovers. There's no cure because they don't know what causes it all the way, but that actually reaches normal functioning is indistinguishable from their peers. By the second grade, it happens, and it happens almost 50% of the time in the programs back in the East Coast. In fact, the commission that was the one before this, I've been doing this for 13 years. This is the third one coming up, and I about fell on my chair when I said they do 25 hours. Because my house that was going to be paid off this year, we owe $220,000 on it. So if that gives you an idea how dedicated we are to applied behavior analysis, we moved to Washington. We flew in people from Kansas, North Carolina, New York, Florida, Southern California, two or three places in California, from Seattle. My wife lived out of state with my son in Washington, Nevada, and North Carolina for over a year each time to bring him treatment. And we've never used drugs on him. And he is severely autistic, but he gets up in the morning and gets himself completely ready for school, takes a shower, puts on his deodorant, fixes his own breakfast, and could not have done that without applied behavior analysis. He would be one of those kids that would be drugged and tied to a bed. That's how severe he is. And he goes places with me. I take him wherever I go, he goes. And sometimes he messes up, but most of the time he's pretty good. But it could not have been possible without ABA. And that's... So if you guys, that's kind of what I wanted to do. I know it's money is a problem, and if we can think outside the box of trying to get money out of the legislation, and maybe if people got together like Northwest Autism Project with Blazers and start having that are fundraisers that are like sponsored by the governor or the governor's wife or your spouses, or you know, where we have a statewide thing. Let's get a good program going here, and that's the criteria for to get your master's degree in, to be a CBA. BCBA. I always get it screwed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Tarter.
Thank you, Representative Gelser and subcommittee members, for allowing me to take this time today. My name is Kate Tarter. I live in Salem. I'm here with my parent hat on. I'm the parent of two children, one without autism and one with autism. My child without autism attends school. It's very easy to get the newsletters and find about sports events and all types of social events. And so I have no trouble finding the resources he needs for his education. My child with autism, essentially, there's nothing in the school newsletter. It's very difficult to find social programs. I'm lucky enough when I moved to Oregon to, first of all, get the correct diagnosis. At 13, he was still not diagnosed with autism. And so I'm thankful to the state of Oregon for spending more money on their children here, because there was a wonderful teacher who said, you know, your child hangs out with the other children that has autism. Do you know what that is? And so thank you, Oregon. One of the things I did do, because there aren't resources, is start a social club at the middle school he was at, and a lot of the children benefited from it. We didn't spend any money. We simply opened the library, two classrooms, the movie room, the craft room, and the basketball room, and they could go from each room. And the kids that weren't in special ed started getting jealous, because how come they're having such a great time? So it was a good turnaround. Unfortunately, after I left the middle school, there was no one who could volunteer their time to continue the program. And as my son moved on to high school, because he had benefited socially and learned how to network children, not just who had autism, but within the youth group and other places, his autism specialist would refer parents to me, and as if I'm supposed to be the social inclusionist. The other thing, too, is where I became his job developer and job coach, because there weren't those types of services in the school, although they have mock interviews and things like that. They did not have an actual place to connect them to facilitate a job, and so I was able to do that for my son, and he's been successfully employed for 3 years. My point here is that as a parent of a child with autism, I became the CEO of a small company, a caregiver, and a community advocate. And so I think that you have very tough decisions to make, and I respect that. I hope that you support autism and individuals who need those supports. I brought you a resource list, because when your constituents call, one thing that would be handy is to have, and you can see this is an extensive list of resources. Unfortunately, this is just in Salem, but I believe no matter where you are in the state, a lot of parents who are, like myself, creating supports for their children are out there to tell you about the resources that are available. So I just wanted to put that point out there, that parents have to create the services when your child has autism a lot of times. And unfortunately, or those parents probably don't have the situation I have, is to work part-time and be able to volunteer my time on my child's behalf, and my heart goes out to those parents. So I think the educational piece is very important, but I won't speak to which pieces because I'm not an expert in that area.
Thank you all very much. And I'm going to ask the committee to hold questions. We have two more folks signed up and about five more minutes of committee time. Thank you all very much. Joyce Besham and Patty Caswell, please. So, Patty Caswell?
I think
she left as well. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you all very much. And many thanks in particular to Representative Edwards, who I know was instrumental in organizing today, and just for his tremendous leadership in the education field, the human service field, and trying to bring all these silos together to better serve kids with autism. And I know we'll be hearing more from the commission and more from all of you as we work to do a better job serving these kids. So thank you all very much, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned.